Do you ever find yourself reminiscing about the good old days? You may laugh to hear this because I know that I'm younger than many of you, but I actually do catch myself doing this sometimes. I find myself saying, well, when I was a child, it was natural to play with neighborhood children in the backyard, unsupervised. Back in my day, there was none of this helicopter parenting. The good old days. I think you might have some memories like this too. A sense of a time when things felt right, when life was simpler, when, for whatever reason, you felt comfortable. I've been asking myself whether this practice of uplifting some portion of the past as better than now, whether that's a universal thing. Throughout history, have people told stories from their past or from the past of their ancestors and wished that it were still fully true in the present? Have there always been those good old days all over the world? Is there something present in all of humanity that on some level laments the loss of the past? Maybe. This morning we sang Issei Barnwell's words, "We are our grandmother's prayers, and we are our grandfather's dreamings. We are the breath of our ancestors. We are the spirit of God." Everything that we are has in some way come from the past, has come from the memories that we hold, and the memories of the people around us, and the stories that come from memories further and further back than any one person can remember. We are memories. Every last thing that we have ever learned is a memory, either of something that we have directly experienced or that was told to us, whether directly or through books or media. Our lives are always learning, and learning is literally creating memories. You know, just as I know, that a single person cannot remember everything. Memory is malleable. You are more likely to remember something notable or important than something completely mundane. I know that I must have traversed the hallway at United Theological Seminary in the Twin Cities hundreds of times, over 3.5 years of classes there. But the only time that I specifically remember going down that hallway was when I was literally running to the chapel to grab a hymnal because I'd completely forgotten that I was responsible for the opening reading in class that afternoon. So I'm running down the hallway and somehow the toe of my Converse sneaker stuck to the floor. Bam! Face planted. Just straight onto my face. I was standing at one moment, the next moment I was on the ground. And I remember lying there, the wind knocked out of me, figuring out, okay, am I actually hurt? Or am I okay? Like, is that pain serious? Or are we good? And then I remember my friend Tara came up to me and helped me stand up. And she told me that she's constantly tripping on lint too. That was notable. And what about our memories of the things that happen over and over again? Those can become really fixed in our minds as well. Maybe you vividly remember day after day at school when the bully tripped you every time you walked past a certain locker. Or you may know your route between home and work so well that you could literally drive it in your sleep. So there, or maybe there's that story that your mother always told her friends, or your father's favorite terrible joke. So it's that repetition that leaves it so fixed in memory. When scientist and writer Oliver Sacks wrote a memoir of his childhood, he included two stories that he remembered clearly of bombs falling behind his home in London during World War II. So he was a child at the time. And one was a 1,000-pound bomb that failed to explode. And he described in his memoir all of the neighbors tiptoeing very quietly back to their homes and bends, hoping beyond hope that any small tremor wouldn't set it off. And the other was a thermite bomb that he remembers, and I quote, burned with a terrible white hot heat. There was a vicious hissing and sputtering when the water hit the white hot metal. And meanwhile, the bomb was melting its own casing and throwing blobs and jets of molten metal in all directions. After the book was published, his brother informed him that they actually hadn't been there for that thermite bomb. The two of them had been at boarding school, but their eldest brother had sent a very detailed, impassioned letter about it. And Oliver writes that his memory of that bomb was just as vivid as any other memory that he knows truly happened. And that he would have no way of telling, based on that recollection, that it actually hadn't happened to him. So memory is this tricky thing. Does it actually matter that he did not directly witness the thermite bomb? Or maybe what matters is how this story fits into who he is, compounding the sense of insecurity and fear for himself and his family during the war. This memory is still a piece of his family. It's a piece of his heart and his understanding of the world. Everything that we are is, to some extent, based on our memories. And they're malleable. So we are malleable based on what we remember. This makes our memories of our experiences and of the stories we are told very powerful in who we are and who we become. What we remember determines our values, and I would like to think that our values in turn continue to determine our behaviors, and those determine our experiences and our memories. So this is some never-ending cycle, constant feedback loop, which makes us who we are. Memories lead to values. Values inform behaviors. Behaviors determine our experiences. And our experiences form memories. This is probably a little too simplistic, but it is at least a starting place as we think about this. And of course, since this is a sermon, I'm going to zero in on the memories to values piece. The stories and experiences that are most a part of who we are, the ones on which we fixate when we are defining ourselves, directly shape what we value. If a person is raised hearing stories about people who work hard to make a lot of money, they are likely to value wealth. If a person learns throughout childhood that weakness will not be tolerated, they will value power. The story of a good life revolves around these values. And a person will act to pursue money and power. And they may or may not notice the needs of those around them because of these memories that shape who they are. And if the stories surrounding a person are about helping others, cooperation and charity may become their values. And if their experiences introduce them to diverse people, their values may focus on inclusion. Of course, the reality of our complex human lives is that we have all had many experiences in different contexts. We've all heard so many stories. And so with that bulk number, they could inform any number of values. So in our memory building, we also have a certain amount of choice. Every time we recall a memory, we have an opportunity to recategorize it when we file it back in our minds. To acknowledge the importance of that memory or to dismiss it is not helpful. So when I shared these two stories with our young people this morning, the different tellings of Rosa Parks, those are stories that I heard. In grade school, I learned that she was a passive actor in the story. And it wasn't until my first year of seminary that I learned about the Highlander Folk School and her involvement with the NAACP and the intense planning behind both the bus boycott and its triggering event. The new story changed my entire understanding of the civil rights movement. I was forced to remember and then recategorize the story I'd originally learned. It wasn't the whole truth, but more importantly, that original story had taught me to value happenstance and passivity as appropriate behavior in response to oppression. The values of the version of the story I learned in seminary were powerful, intentional organizing, working together, planning, and self-sacrifice to bring forth change. It was the difference between one tired woman and a force of dedicated, impassioned people. It matters what we focus on in our memories and in the stories, the history that we've learned, the ones that we tell ourselves, the ones that we teach to our children. And if the values we espouse and the memories and the stories on which we focus do not match, it's very challenging to live out our values. So I'm going to uplift Ariel Dorfman's words from this morning's reading. Where is my America? The America that taught me tolerance of every race and every religion, that filled me with pioneer energy, that is generous to a fault when catastrophes strike. She wouldn't use these loaded, overused words, but could we not summarize her intention with the words, "Make America Great Again"? She chooses to focus on her memories of justice, freedom, and diversity when she reflects upon this country. Some prefer to focus on memories of power, freedom, and individualism. What memories do we focus on? What values do we encourage in our lives and in our community? What collective memories of our country will we choose to remember? This church community, as a member congregation of the Unitarian Universalist Association, covenants to affirm and promote, and if you want to read along with me, they're on the back of your order of service, the inherent worth and dignity of every person, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, acceptance of one another, and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, the right of conscience and the use of the democratic process within our congregations and in society at large, the goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. These are the principles and purposes that we have agreed upon as Unitarian Universalists. They espouse our values. And I will tell you this morning, without question, that our faith calls each of us to vote these values on Tuesday. We value voting. It's right there in the fifth principle, use of the democratic process in society at large. We value participating in democracy, and your faith calls on you to vote. We value compassion in the second principle. We vote with compassion and inform that with the first principle, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Rhetoric of hate falls outside of this value. As a faith, we side with love. We are called to act in the service of love, to act and care for all people. And that brings me to, we value world community, the sixth principle. People all over the world matter to us. Any place where there is suffering causes suffering for us. And we're serious about peace, liberty, and justice in our own communities, in our country, and throughout the world. Your faith calls you to vote for peacemakers and justice seekers. If our leaders do not pursue faith, liberty, and justice for all, we cannot in good conscience support them. We value the environment, the seventh principle. As a faith that supports a responsible search for truth, the fifth principle, we support evidence-based science, and it has become clear that the world's climate is changing, and that we must act to prevent it from getting so much worse, causing devastating effects on human life and the entirety of the natural world. And finally, we value the right of conscience. That's the fifth principle. And really, this, the right of conscience, is the most important reason I will never endorse parties or candidates from the pulpit. Sure, legally, to do so would put the church's tax-exempt status at risk. Yes, preaching parties and candidates could alienate members and visitors. But our very faith itself asks you to do the hard work of following your own conscience. Not mine. It is not my place to tell you how to vote. You possess the right of conscience to act out of your own understanding of the world. You have your own memories to guide you. Those very memories of your experiences, of the books and articles that you have read, of the news reports you have heard, of the stories that you've been told. Your memories, created by you, recollected by you, recategorized by you. These form your conscience and give you the tools that you need to exercise your democratic rights on Tuesday. And I pray that the values of our faith have shaped your memories. I pray that somewhere in those memories, the very stories that we have told as a church, the stories that you tell yourself again and again, I pray that in those you are able to hold on to hope. Hope that a world community of peace, liberty, and justice for all is possible. And that we have the ability to help build it. Hold tightly to whatever memories give you this hope, and let them guide your conscience. May it be so. Amen.